Welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In the second half of today's program, we're diving into North Dakota's foster care system. We'll explore the current need for foster parents, the challenges in recruiting and retaining them, and the innovative strategies being implemented to ensure the success of the program here in North Dakota. Joining us will be Kelsey Bless, Licensing Unit Administrator, and Jennifer Thorson, Foster Care Licensing Specialist. Both work for the Department of Health and Human Services. But first, we turn our attention to the pressing issue of affordable housing, especially here in the Fargo-Moorhead region. Since 2020, Trenton Garretts has been the Executive Director of the Cass Clay Community Land Trust, an organization dedicated to creating sustainable, affordable home ownership opportunities. We'll discuss the challenges of maintaining long-term affordability, how the shared equity model works, and what it means for families seeking stability and security through home ownership.
Trenton Garretts, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
In the introduction, I introduced you as the Executive Director of the Cass Clay Community Land Trust. Mm-hmm. What is that?
Cass Clay Community Land Trust is a nonprofit organization that specializes in offering low to moderate income households home ownership opportunities throughout the Cass and Clay County.
Is it an issue? Is it a problem? Are there statistics that say we have an affordable housing problem here in the region?
Yes, very much so. Actually, in 2015, there's a workforce study that was completed that indicated three major issues that our community has for attracting and retaining a skilled workforce, which were transportation, childcare, and housing. Furthermore, in 2022, MetroCog did a housing study, a regional housing study, that concluded that less than 50% of our current residents have the ability to purchase an average priced home of $274,000. Fast forward a couple years later, the average sales price is actually above $300,000 now, so it's only growing.
What's the solution then? One of the basic things that people want is a safe place to live.
Yep. Specialize in home ownership. So generally, we either build or we will acquire and rehab single family homes, detached homes that we work to bring in other additional funding to help bring down the purchase price. So that way, low to moderate income households can afford them. So we're more on the home ownership side, although we do work with, like, Beyond Shelters, somebody that does a lot of affordable housing as it relates to apartments, Fargo Housing as well. So we do work with those, but that's they handle that side of it. We handle the home ownership side.
How do you approach people, or how do people approach you to say, I've heard about your program, maybe this could help me afford a home?
We've been very quiet by design. Because we know there's a lot of demand, we have been pretty quiet about what we're doing because we don't want to get too many people excited because we just don't have that much inventory currently. And so we don't want to have a huge waiting list, people waiting to get into homes, if you will. So generally, the way people hear about us is through our partners, through a Beyond Shelter or a Habitat for Humanity, Fargo Housing, et cetera, CAPLP, to name a few. But typically, we get a lot of our leads through the MLS, the listing service, for when we have a property for sale. We work with a current realtor. They list it, and that's generally how we get a lot of our clients.
Are you hoping to serve families with kids, older folks, single parents, all of the above?
All of the above. We have anywhere from, well, a majority of our households right now, we have 11 households right now. Of those, six of them, are single parent led. Or a single individual in those homes. We have a couple homes and actually working with two more households that have special circumstances, making sure the home is accessible and those things as well. It doesn't matter. Anybody that's looking to be into home ownership.
Your literature talks about a shared equity model.
Yes.
What is that?
Shared equity model is in exchange for the investment that we're putting up front, we ask that our homeowners, and actually you have to, I guess, as a land trust, that you're going to share a portion of your appreciated gain in your house with the next homeowner. Reason for that is so that way we don't have to continue to invest into that property and it'll maintain its long-term affordability.
It's interesting. So if my home I purchased from you for $200,000 mm-hmm. is worth $400,000 when I choose to move on,
right,
I'm moving forward $200,000 of that equity to a new homeowner.
Not all of that. Our shared equity model would state that you'd get 25% of that. So you'd get $50,000 of that. So the other $150,000 would stay with that home. And And it's very important, I think, for people to understand that that's not how the land trust it gets paid, is taking that other 75%. That $150,000 stays with that house. So to use your example, if your house was now valued at 400 and you bought it for 200 and we add in your equity that 50,000, we would sell that house for $250,000 to another income qualified family. So that income qualified family, the next house owner, would be buying a $400,000 house at $250,000.
What income eligibility requirements are out there for people to take advantage of your services?
Yeah, we technically go up to 120% area median income. However, a majority of our funders require 80% area median income, which is considered moderate income, household income. To put that into a little bit of perspective, you're talking about, for a household of four within our region, you're talking about roughly $90,000 is what 80% area median income would be.
I'm sure that demand far out exceeds inventory.
Yes.
How can we move forward to get those numbers maybe a little better even, perhaps, that inventory can then meet demand?
There's a lot of pieces to that puzzle. So some of that has to do with interest rates from a few years back. People have refinanced at 3%, and very few people want to move now and refinance at almost 7%. So once that kind of levels out a little bit, that will help open up some more inventory. Senior housing is also a really big issue. We have a lot of seniors that are aging in place, which is great, but we also have some that are forced to age in place as well because there just is nowhere for them to go. And so freeing up a few of those homes as well would be helpful. But we also have a lot of vacant lots, blighted homes throughout our community. Like every other community, we're no worse than anybody else. It's just that we have those opportunities, taking advantage of that through a land trust or through other programs like Rebuilding Together, Habitat could also be another way to help increase that inventory. But the other hard reality of it is building a new home is just not cheap. You know, material costs have gone up, labor costs have gone up, everything has gone up. So just the sheer price of building a new home, it isn't what it used to be. So programs like the land trust that work to secure outside funds to help bring down those purchase prices is a good solution. There's one good solution to help solve that, because not only can we help bring down the price of current homes or new builds, but we can then also maintain that long-term affordability, so that way the next generation of home buyers can also have the opportunity to buy a home.
Oftentimes with programs similar, perhaps maybe larger in scope, maybe not, people generally are supportive until it happens next door to them, not in my backyard. Do you experience that?
We do on occasion. But one thing that's really different about us is, in order for you to qualify for a land trust home, you have to be able to secure a conventional mortgage. So this isn't a handout by any means. And once I start to explain to people that who we're talking about your neighbors are, just to give you an example of some of our current homeowners, we have two nurses, we have a mental health therapist, we have somebody that's in the armed forces, we have a construction worker, we have a teacher, the typical neighbor that you already have. That's who's moving into your house or into your neighborhood.
What are some misunderstandings that people have about what you do?
The biggest one is the shared equity piece. People don't understand why you'd want to give up a portion of your equity. And I think it's really important for people to understand that everybody that comes to our office, everybody that I counsel, I will tell them that if you can find your dream house for whatever amount that you are approved to purchase, go do that. That is a much better deal, buying a conventional house on the conventional market. But if you can't get into that and you want to start building some equity and you're tired of paying rent, then we're a good option. So we're really kind of a niche program in that sense. If a new constructed home right now is roughly $425,000. So you're talking about having to have a down payment of $80,000 just to get in there. That's really tough for a lot of families to get in there with childcare and other things that are on top of that. The other one that we get a little pushback on is the idea of separating the land from the actual home improvement. So the land or the land trust will always maintain the rights to land underneath the home, and then the homeowner will own the structure, the improvements, the house. Some people have a real hard time understanding that. And the reason for that is That allows us then to be able to set the resale restrictions so we can make sure that it's affordable for the next person. It helps us to put a few guidelines in place, such as this is your primary residence and, you know, that you're not subletting it out and those kinds of things to make sure that it is a true home ownership opportunity. One of the other things that we have in our policies and within the ground lease is you cannot have more than 20% of the purchase price of your home in liquid assets after your close. And the reason for that rule really is because we don't want people selling their $400,000 house and then coming to us, and they might income qualify, but we don't want them to come to us then and say, well, heck, I can get a $150,000 house now and still keep my $200,000 gain. That's not who we're trying to serve. We're trying to serve the families and the households that are in that renting situation that want to get into home ownership and are ready to get in there, but just need that little bit of help.
Join our conversation with Trenton Garedz. He's the executive director of the Cass Clay Community Land Trust. This assumption to me hopes, and we all hope, that housing prices, that our equity in our homes rise.
Correct.
What happens if it falls?
Yeah, that's a great question. Fortunately or unfortunately, you have the same risk as any homeowner does. The good news is, though, because you're purchasing those homes for generally much less than what the market value is on them or appraised market value is on them, there's a larger gap in between where you purchased it and where the market is.
And theoretically, over time, 10, 15, 20 years from now, that gap grows, but we're still benefiting from the very first person who purchased
Correct.
That home
yes.
a long time ago.
For the first homeowner is probably the toughest in the sense that, you know, we put in subsidies or investments into the property to bring it down. Even in your example, when you say, hey, now my house is worth $400,000, you can see real quick that they got a $250,000 house or a $400,000 house for $250,000. There's a lot of equity built up in there already. So the housing prices would have to fall pretty far to impact our homeowners. And actually, if you go back and look at 2009, 10, 11, when we had the housing crisis across the country, land trust homes were less than 1% of foreclosures. Double check that stat, but I'm pretty sure that's what it was.
Is this program unique to Fargo-Moorhead, or are there many programs like it across the country?
There's many like this across the country. There's over 200. There is 15 in the state of Minnesota. There is 3 in North Dakota. One in us in Fargo, Cass Clay Community Land Trust, and there's one in Grand Forks and one in Minot as well.
How do you provide educational resources to people who are interested in maybe this might work for me?
Yeah.
How do you help them?
Basically, you fill out an interest survey, just some qualifying questions. If you meet our income guidelines and those things, then we ask for you to fill out an application. You fill that out, you send it in to us, then we go ahead and we meet. We go through this packet of information, which I'll give to you here. It's a home orientation. Through that, we require a couple different things. One of the things we require is that they attend a first-time home buyers education course. We leave that up to the professionals to do that, and so we give them a list of resources and people they can go to for that. The other thing we ask is that they obviously get approved for a mortgage and do those things. But another thing that's a little unique is we actually ask for them to go meet with an attorney of their choice to walk through our ground lease, which is the document that binds us together in the land and the improvements. And so we ask them to do that. And actually, the land trust pays for that consultation as well. So again, we want to make sure that every one of our homeowners understands the ground lease and what it means to get into home ownership and those things. Once they actually purchase the home, our goal, long-term goal, is that we're going to have a post-stewardship program where we'll be working with our homeowners to help them in their first time, generally first time home buying experience. Some of our homeowners now have even asked, you know, like, what flowers do I plant? You know, and so, you know, are there classes and things, resources we can connect them with? Are there resources we can connect them with for home maintenance and those things? And so, and trying to teach them how to maintain their home. Quick example, we have one homeowner. She's originally from Louisiana. They moved here from California. They got into a new home. Everything was going great. But she called me one day and said, our house is too cold. I have to wear a sweatshirt everywhere I go. It's just cold. So I went out there, I brought a technician with, went out there, took a look, and unbeknownst to her, she just didn't know. But what she was doing is she had all the heat trapped in her bedroom where it was nice and warm, because that's where she wanted to sleep and be warm, but it wasn't then getting to the house, right? So it was taking that education piece to say, you got to open these vents. You got to open your door. Do not touch this. Just let it go. Oh, okay. And we haven't had an issue since. But, you know, so there's just some of those, again, I think things that people that have owned their homes for many years take for granted. I know when to change my furnace filter, but until somebody told me, I never changed it either, you know, and taught me how to do it. So it's those kinds of things that we'd keep working with.
How do you measure that you're successful?
We define success in two ways. The first way is that we have enough homes on the market that fill the need for our community. Not every home in our community should be a land trust home. That's not good for our community. I mean, we need to have a good mix. And so we understand that. But we would love to get to a point where the amount of homes that we have within our community are meeting our needs. So that's our first measurable. The second one is our actual homeowners. How many of them are moving into the home and then moving on to a conventional home ownership situation? Although you can live in our homes forever, we really hope that you use this as that stepping stone, as that 7 to maybe 15 years, whatever it might be, to then move on to a more conventional home ownership situation.
Funding, where do you get your money?
A lot of it's grants. State of Minnesota is a very big supporter of ours. Well, Minnesota Housing through the state of Minnesota is a very big partner of ours. North Dakota Housing has been a very good partner. So a lot of fundraising, a lot of community-wide, a lot of banks are great supporters of us as well. And so that's generally how we do it. Some of the other funding we get is through our activities. So we do, like every time we build a house, there's a very small developer fee we put on that as well. But again, we have to be very careful what we charge as developer fees and those things, because everything we charge to a house or to a property impacts that long-term affordability. We have to be very careful and find that sweet spot, if you will, to make sure that we're not jeopardizing the long-term affordability. And unfortunately, that sometimes leads to us not getting anything, which is fine. That's not why we're in it. But those are our two major sources.
If I said you had 10 houses now, how many would you need to fulfill demand?
My first thought and goal is we want to get to 100 homes and then we'll reevaluate. Because I think it's twofold. Honestly, I think a community our size, probably closer to 300 would probably be the right number.
And you're talking about the Fargo-Moorhead area.
Yeah, region. Horace, Dilworth, the entire metro area. With that being said, 300 homes is kind of what my gut tells me. I haven't done the analysis. We just want to get to the first 100 and then kind of reevaluate. But the other side of that equation is getting into a pattern of having homes turnover, right? So on average, a land trust homeowner is a very typical conventional homeowner in the sense that they move about every 7 to 10 years, like most people do. We're not that old yet, so we haven't seen that happen. Ideally, we would have enough turnover in our houses every year that we wouldn't have to build 20 or 30 more. Every year we could do 2 or 3 to meet demand. So once we kind of are a little bit more established, we'll have a better feel for how many more we're going to need, because a lot of it's going to be on that turnover side of it.
Where can folks go for more information?
They can certainly go to our website, which is cassclayclt.org. They can also always just give us a call or send an email as well.
Let's dive down a little bit on partnerships. Who are your great partners and what do they do for you?
We have a lot of partners. As cliche as this is going to sound, the word community is part of Community Land Trust, and that has to stay in the forefront of us. We are part of the community. Truly a land trust, a community land trust, develops land, purchases land, acquires it for whatever, and then utilizes it for whatever the community determines is the best use for that land. In our case, it happens to be single family housing. So we do a lot of that. We've worked with a variety of builders. Again, our funding partners. We also have an agent, real estate agent that we work with, title companies that we work with, lenders that we work with to help our homeowners as well get through the process of buying their house. And then rehabbers as well. You name it. Anything that has to do with housing, we're pretty much partnering with somebody to do it. And we do that for two different reasons. One, it has to be a community-led operation. I mean, our organization is not interested in telling people what we need to build and do here. We want the community to tell us what we should build and do here by working with not only neighborhood associations and architects and builders. One thing most neighborhoods want is a house that looks like every other house in the neighborhood, right? They want it to look the same. So really being cognizant of that and working with the partners and the residents that are there to help design that house and to help put it there so it makes sense and to really educate and bring people along. So we will not be successful if the community doesn't support us with time, talent, or treasure. I mean, we just won't.
We're coming into winter. That shouldn't slow anyone down from inquiring about how you can help.
Correct. Matter of fact, although they won't be ready this winter, but still thinking about buying. We're working with Thompson Homes right now. We're developing 2 6-bedroom homes over in Johnson Farm area in South Moorhead. Those are for purposely for larger families or multi-generational families. So the idea there is we have a growing population that is living multi-generationally, and so let's build a home and see how it looks. And so we're piloting it out. We've heard there's lots of demand. We've asked and we've seen that there's demand, and now we're gonna test it. So if that goes well and we can sell them fast, and you know we get the right people in the homes, then we'll look to build more. Again, the community and the market kind of dictate what we're gonna do.
And as we wrap it up, generally, would you rather buy a property and rehab it, or would you rather buy new, build new?
There's benefits to both and cons to both, certainly. Depending on how much rehab needs to be done, that is probably my preferred. We're a staff of two. My other staff member might have a different opinion on it, but I would say that's my preferred. And the reason for that is because you're taking an existing house and you're protecting that existing housing stock and rehabbing it, bringing it back and bringing new life into it. And it's then already part of a neighborhood and part of a community, if you will. From a cost standpoint, it's probably not any less or more to do that, but you typically don't have special assessments on those projects, so that helps with cost a little bit. The problem is I don't know if you ever watched the house flipping shows, but they always tell you, oh, well, now you need to put in a new, I need more money because you have to put in a new bathroom or this broke or that broke. That's true. And so you never really know what you're walking into. New construction is great because it's typically part of a development. It's easier to share costs across an entire development instead of just one home. But that comes with lack of a neighborhood feel currently because it's a newer neighborhood, right? And two, special assessments come with that as well. Plus, it's a little bit more expensive probably to build than it is to acquire and rehab, obviously depending on how much rehab is needed and the acquisition price.
And lastly, Trenton, are there any local, state, or federal policies or laws that you're working to maybe modify to help you out?
Not currently, but we have a couple on our minds. So I shouldn't say that. There's in the state of Minnesota, we're working to try to get our property tax rate recognized more at a multi-family rate instead of a single family. Meaning that apartment buildings, multifamily units are charged. I want to say I have a property tax rate of, I think it's 0.25, or it's going down to 0.25. For a land trust home in Minnesota, it's 0.75. And I believe for regular home ownership, it's 1%. So there's a little bit of savings there. We want to try to get that down further because that is another one of our concerns about taxing our people out of homes down the road. That's one. Another one that we're just starting to look into and seeing what we would need to do to make it happen is the conversion from a former low-income housing tax credit projects. A lot of times when you're building apartment buildings or even some developments, they utilize low-income housing tax credits. Typically, once those are done, those credits run out. Developers or whoever owns it will sell it to the highest bidder, which makes sense, but is there a possibility to get more points for your low-income housing tax credit if the application if you decide to include a land trust at the end? So what I'm saying is that at the end of that, the time the tax credits run out, that the land trust could come in and start to transition those tenants into owner-occupied housing. We're doing a project like that with the city of Moorhead up with Maple Court, and we're working with Beyond Shelter right now to transition some homes in Blue Stem here in the near future. So we're dabbling in it a little bit, but we want to do see if we can make that even bigger. So I think there's a long-term benefit there that hasn't been capitalized on yet.
Best wishes to you, Trenton.
Thank you. But thank you for having me.
Trenton Garrett is the executive director of Cass Clay Community Land Trust, a position he's held since May of 2020. Thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, proud to partner with Strengthen ND to announce the 2024 Bush Prize North Dakota winners, North Dakota Native Vote, and North Dakota Assistive. More information online at bushfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We wanted to understand more about North Dakota's foster care system.
What does it mean to be a foster care provider for both the home and the parents and for the young person who may be needing foster care? With me to discuss is Kelsey Bless. She's a licensing unit administrator for Children and Family Services. Kelsey, welcome to Main Street.
Hello, thank you.
And Jennifer Thorson. She's also a licensed social worker. She's a foster care licensing specialist. Both work with the Department of Health and Human Services, Children and Family Services section. Jennifer, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you, Craig.
Kelsey, let me start with you if I could. What is the current need for foster parents in North Dakota? And how has this need evolved in recent years?
Well, Craig, it's always a great question for us because in our world, we are constantly on the move to be recruiting providers across the state of North Dakota. You know, we've been really lucky in North Dakota that we have seen a reduction in the number of children that are in foster care, but that does not reduce the need for families to open their heart and home at any given time. So we are always wanting to have a push for recruitment. We never stop recruitment of family foster homes. And I would always reiterate that there's a need no matter what.
Sure, Kelsey. I'm very curious though. Why has there been a reduction in the need? That sounds like a good thing to me.
It's a fantastic thing. And I do credit all of our local public agencies, our human service zones and the Division of Juvenile Services and our tribal nations who are doing the really front level, ground level work in working with families to offer some prevention and really offering in-home services and trying to put services into the family rather than removing kids on a dime. You know, in the past, we did have probably a higher removal rate because of just looking at the cases differently. And for the last 4 years, almost 5 years, North Dakota has engaged in what's called the Safety Framework Practice Model. And it really is our foundation to working with families to look at what present danger is in that home versus maybe some impending dangers that we could work with families to reduce the risk. I think our human service zones have done such an amazing job of looking differently and engaging differently with families in our child welfare system today. So that has left children more with familiar relatives and with their own parents, and we put services into those homes.
Jennifer, let me ask you, what are the biggest challenges that you would tell me in recruiting and retaining foster care providers? And what strategies have you used that have really been successful in addressing those challenges?
Probably myth busting about what foster care is and what it is not. There's, you know, some different myths that circulate, and our CFS licensing staff has been working really hard to change the narrative around that. One example would be availability. Sometimes providers or prospective providers are wondering, you know, do I have to be available 24/7? That's too much of a time commitment. You know, that's an example of a myth. There's many ways to provide foster care services. Providers can do short-term care, long-term care. They can be available to provide shelter care, emergency on-call placements. So many different ways to serve as a foster care provider.
I've always wondered if I could be, Jennifer, a foster care provider in that. The attachment. A young person coming into my home, I just want the absolute best for them. And then they perhaps move back to a better situation than they had before. It would be hard for me to manage that. What do you tell folks that are thinking like that?
Yeah, that's probably one of the most common concerns I hear from prospective providers. And, you know, I think we kind of need to reframe that as, yes, you are going to form attachments and relationships with the child, but that's exactly the kind of person that we want providing care. The children who are entering a foster care placement really need somebody who's going to be able to commit and connect and form those caring relationships with them. And so, yes, there might be some sense of loss when a child does leave your home, but really the benefits to the child are, we can't measure that.
Are there challenges, Kelsey, in rural North Dakota versus, and I use this in air quotes, a little bit urban North Dakota, in other words, the larger communities in North Dakota versus the real remote rural parts of the state?
You know, I think the number one thing that we likely hear from providers, but also case managers in the field, when we're comparing our rural communities to our more urban, is likely the service availability. So when we have individuals who really want to provide foster care and they live in a small remote countryside of North Dakota, like many of our communities are, that doesn't discount their availability or need, but we might have to be a little bit more creative about transportation and how we might work together with the case manager if someone's working to get kids to their therapies or to get them to the dentist, if we have to travel a little ways to get into our larger communities for those types of services. But ultimately, I mean, I think we've had a lot of opportunity in North Dakota to have more rural health and, you know, telehealth services, which is really helpful. But ultimately, that's probably the number one thing we hear is, how am I going to have access to services in the rural communities? And I also think in our rural communities, I don't want anyone to believe that foster care doesn't exist there, because it does. As our rural communities age, we know there are younger families who might be interested, and to not sell yourself short, because if that's something that you have a calling for or you're curious about, there is a need for you all over North Dakota, not just in our larger community.
Jennifer, describe for me the licensing process. Okay, I've done exactly what Kelsey suggested. I've thought about it. This could work for us, but what does that mean? So what are the requirements, Jennifer?
So the first step would be for individuals or couples to complete an application. And we have an easy, I think, 1 or 2 page application. The next step is the individuals would be connected with a coordinator in our licensing unit, and they would help them start the process of completing a background check. We do a fingerprint-based criminal background check, which is free of charge for applicants. And then the next step would be us being assigned to a licensing specialist, who then would begin a home study assessment in the applicant's home. And the home study typically would consist of about 3 face-to-face visits with a licensing specialist, usually in the individual or family's home. Then there's some other requirements as far as home safety. We need to make sure that homes have fire safety equipment like extinguishers, smoke detectors, need to make sure homes have carbon monoxide detectors, and just a generally safe environment for children.
What about space requirements? Do I need to provide a separate bedroom, for example, for multiple foster children who might be in my care?
The main requirement is that each child would have their own bed while they're in placement. Children can share rooms, and we have some recommendations and requirements based on the age of the child, the gender of the child, but they do not need to have their own room.
Kelsey, how is a child in North Dakota placed in the foster care system?
So we have in North Dakota 3 primary public agencies who receive court-ordered custody of children. And so, you know, back in the day, you might have heard social services or county social services. Now, in the last 5 years, we have been changing the language around that to human service zones. So a human service zone would get custody. We also have an agreement with the Division of Juvenile Services where we have young people who may have received a delinquent charge who are in need of out-of-home care. And so Division of Juvenile Services is included, as well as our 4 of the 5 tribal nations in North Dakota. We do have 1 tribe that is the Sisseton-Wahpeton area, and they work primarily with South Dakota. So if you're listening in from the southeast portion of the state, the Sisseton-Wahpeton tribe does work with South Dakota, but all other tribes do work with the North Dakota Department of Health and Human Services. So when a child is removed from their home, it is because of present danger. So law enforcement or maybe a child protected issue comes up and the agency is contacted. And so when an emergency removal happens, that custodian is required to identify and secure a placement for that child. And so the case managers are looking for primarily relatives or someone known to that individual. It might be a neighbor. It could be a teacher from the school who says, oh, you know what, if this child needs a place to go, let me know. They don't always have to be licensed right off the bat to be a placement resource. And so I know our agencies do a great job of trying to turn over every rock, because that child is going to want to go and sleep at someone's house that they know, they feel more comfortable with. And if they're old enough to tell us, they'll say, oh, you know, my grandma, she lives in South Bismarck. Really? What's grandma's name? So there's a lot of interviewing, per se, that happens with those children right off the bat. But ultimately, they're placed into foster care because of present danger. And then the case managers work with the bio parents or the guardian to determine, what is this danger? How can we assist you? What can we do to help mitigate this risk and get these kids back into your home as soon as possible?
We are enjoying our conversation, trying to understand more about North Dakota's foster care system and what it means to be a foster care provider with Kelsey Bless. She's a licensed social worker and a licensing unit administrator,
and Jennifer Thorson. She's a foster care licensing specialist, also a licensed social worker. Both work for the Department of Health and Human Services, Children and Family Services section. Jennifer, what types of support are available for foster families? Financial, emotional, logistical. How are those provided to foster parents in North Dakota to help them succeed in their role as a foster care provider?
Well, foster homes or foster care providers receive a daily stipend to offset the costs of providing care to children who are in foster care. The amount of reimbursement that they receive month to month depends on the need and the needs of the child and the age of the child. Providers also receive contact information for the custodial agency. They have on-call workers, so foster parents can be assured that they can reach someone at the public agency 24/7 in case there's an emergency or they have a need that comes up. And then in addition, the licensing specialists are in frequent contact with the providers. We check in with providers often to ensure that they have what they need. We offer them technical assistance, access to different supports, some connections to other providers, support groups. We have a mentoring program for foster parents. We also offer grief and loss counseling services when that's needed. Then in addition, we provide training frequently throughout the year. That's free of charge to the providers, and you know, both in-person and online training is available. We have respite care services for the children in placement if that's a need as well.
How long generally are children placed in foster care? Do we know?
Sure, Craig, this is Kelsey. I can help you with that. So ultimately, the goal is that we would have a child in North Dakota foster care for the least amount of time possible. And in the event, you know, when an agency does get court ordered services, they usually get that court order for up to 1 year. And so it would be a really great goal to get a child returned to their families within, you know, 90 days or even 6 months if we could. But we really do strive, and the federal standard is that kids are returned within that 12-month time frame as well.
And Kelsey, then how does the North Dakota Foster Parent Program address cultural needs and community needs to make sure that children are placed in homes that really align with their backgrounds and identities? And this could include religious priorities of a family.
I think ultimately the public agencies, when a child does come into care, they're working alongside mom, dad, maybe grandparents if they aren't unable to care for the child, really trying to identify what are the cultural needs of the child so that they can execute that in their plan, that they can make sure that they're accommodating those needs. Religion oftentimes comes up, religious events and customs come up. Obviously, race is a big indicator. And in North Dakota, we have a large number of Native American families that we work alongside, especially as we're working closely with our tribal nations. And so really wanting to ensure that those cultural needs and the family connections, the events, the food, the any type of opportunity that a child would be doing if they were at home with mom and dad, really to be mirrored in foster care. And so we do promote a lot of normalcy activities, and the case managers alongside our foster care providers are always looking for what's happening in the community. Where can we go to get this done? And let's say that a provider foster home is not Catholic, but they are Baptist and the child is Catholic. They would then work with individuals in their community, maybe a friend or a neighbor, who would say, I'll pick up the child on Sunday morning and take them to church. And so really having those connections, and that's such a North Dakota thing, isn't it? Like, we help each other out. That would be one of the strategies to ensure that those cultural needs are met for the children when they're in placement.
And Kelsey, before we move on, I'm guessing it's a high priority to keep siblings together.
Absolutely. And I have to credit our public agencies for really advocating that siblings stay together. Now, for the most part, we're pretty successful and the family foster homes are very willing. However, on occasion, we'll get a family that does percolate that might have, you know, 5, 6, 8 children. And so keeping them all together is a little bit more challenging. Not to say it's never been done, but we might have to do a little bit more of a circle of homes approach where two families get the placement of the, you know, 6 kids, and then they meet up a couple nights a week, or they're doing FaceTime calls, or they have a weekend visit, and those types of family connections are maintained, but they're just not living under the same roof until reunification can happen.
Speaking of reunification, Jennifer, That would be the best moment, perhaps. How are they supported to navigate that reunification effort with their biological families? And how do you balance the need to do that versus other priorities of the program?
Well, the public agency or the custodian is required to maintain regular contact with the birth family. And then the worker from the agency would also be in frequent contact with the foster care provider. They would see the child face-to-face every month. And so this ongoing communication is essential in supporting the goal. In the majority of cases, the goal is reunification and is a priority. And so the worker helping the biological family through what needs to occur for reunification is necessary. And then as part of that, keeping the foster care provider in the loop as the primary caregiver to the child and a family resource, that is imperative to case success. You know, I think we see the best outcomes when we can see foster parents engaged with birth parents. It's very good for the child and best outcomes for the child if they can see both providers and their birth parents working together. We've seen some amazing outcomes with foster parents being a great support to bio families, sometimes almost taking on a mentoring role. I've seen some very nice relationships develop. Sometimes we have foster parents who can form enough of a relationship with birth parents that they can invite them into their home or include them in different activities with children. If there's a birthday party for a child, including parents in that, or attending events in the community together, if a child's involved in a sports activity, for example. You know, we've seen, like I said, some very nice relationships develop and really help toward reaching the goal of reunification.
That certainly sounds so natural, and it's something that I hadn't thought about, that a foster family would communicate with the biological family. Certainly, it's easy to see how that would be very, very beneficial to the person in foster care. That's really cool. Kelsey, how do you know you're successful? How do you identify what you do works?
Sure. So before I touch on success, I just want to acknowledge that component of mentoring a little bit that Jennifer alluded to, because so often I think it's like also a bit of a myth that when a child comes into foster care, then you don't, as the family foster home, you don't have to communicate with bio families, or I don't need to, or I don't want to. And I think the myth busting on that is that oftentimes our family foster care providers want to. They want to see the success of this family, that they can have their child back and that they can see them hug. We've had teachable moments where the foster care providers have, you know, that maybe there's a baby born and they have been probably the best mentor to that bio mom to show her how to feed the baby, how to bathe the baby. And those are just little things that go so far. And I just want to acknowledge it because I think it happens more often than people believe can. And I think that's great. So to me, that's a huge success, as you ask about success, that we are opening hearts and homes to not only the children, but to their families. And one thing that we do within program administration, so I've been with the department for nearly 15 years, and we have been tracking foster care numbers for a very, very long time. But what we know is that data tells our story. And so if we don't have data, we can't justify any of the gains that we have made and really help us in making better decisions along the way. And so, you know, we track all kinds of stuff, from numbers of reports that come in, what prevention services are being offered, how many families have access services, length of stay for children who are in care, because ideally, if you would want a child to, if they have to come into care, you want them to be returned timely and quickly. We know that not every case works like that. And so we look at that case and say, tell me why. Why are we not getting these children home before the 12-month court order expires and we have to ask for an extension? So there's all kinds of pieces. We also look at a permanency goal achievement. A large number of our children who come into care in North Dakota are reunified, but if they cannot be reunified, there is other options for them. So it might be guardianship with grandma. It might be adoption to a relative in or out of state, it could be a foster care provider who has been known to that child for some time. And so lots of opportunity there. We get a lot of feedback from case managers and from providers along the way. So we're always asking, what do you see is working well?
We have just a few seconds left. If someone thinks they may want to become a foster care provider, what should they do right now?
Contact the CFS licensing unit, and you can reach the unit either by phone. The phone number is 701-328-2322, or by email, and the email address is cfslicensing@nd.gov. And we have that phone line, and the email is answered throughout the day, and somebody would respond very quickly.
My guests have been Kelsey Bless and Jennifer Thorson. Both work for the Department of Health and Human Services in the Children and Family Services section. We've been learning about foster parenting and foster care in North Dakota. Ladies, thank you so much for joining us today on Main Street.
Thank you, Craig. Have a great day.
Thanks for having us.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 18th. On this date, in 1922, Joseph Gleason fell ill after enjoying a hearty pork steak dinner at his restaurant and rooming house near the Northern Pacific Depot. He'd also eaten some candy purchased elsewhere. Blind Joe, who lived with his mother and business partner Mrs. Skeel, was a well-known figure on the streets of Wahpeton for 23 years. That night, he staggered as he made his way to bed. Mrs. Skeel assisted him up the stairs, but the next day he passed away around 2 p.m. Newspaper reports and rumors suggested he might have been poisoned by the candy or through other means. A coroner's quest was held. Gleason had a reputation for both dubious business dealings in Wahpeton and charitable work for the blind in Chicago, where he and Mrs. Skeel spent the winters. He was an active member and promoter of the Braille Music Club of Chicago, an organization of blind musicians. The club's president was a prominent society woman married to a Chicago newspaper editor. Gleason was also linked to bootlegging and houses of ill repute in the NP Depot neighborhood, where he owned several properties. One of these was the old Continental Hotel, later known as the Sherman House. In 1909, newspapers reported that Gleason had bought the hotel and was converting it into a restaurant and men's rooming house. In 1914, he was arrested for operating a house of ill repute at another property he owned south of the hotel. Earlier in 1905, he'd been charged with a similar offense, along with Cora Berry, a notorious woman associated with the house. The coroner's jury conducted an inquest and autopsy, ultimately dismissing rumors of poisoning. The cause of death was determined to be heart failure due to valvular lesions that had developed over several years. The county official suggested that his heavy evening meal may have contributed to his demise. Local papers later reported that the Larson Auto Wrecking Company had purchased Blind Joe's hotel building with plans to convert it into a showroom and shop. Contents left inside included furniture, stoves, dishes, miscellaneous articles, a roulette wheel, and provisions for a good meal, though the bread was described as somewhat dry. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Lee Zerdrick. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
And that's a wrap for today's edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Remember, you can hear this and all past episodes of Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Tomorrow on the show, we'll focus on giving, especially as this holiday time approaches. We'll visit with the United Way team at United Way of Cass Clay. Their team is committed and excited to work with donors, volunteers, and partners, and we'll learn what all that means. That's coming up Tuesday on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.